Welcome to Combox Live. Jared Kimber here with his show, my show, Show of the People. This is Wagon Wheel, where I answer your questions on cricket. Generally, we do this show live, but we're in a hotel where we're not quite sure about the Wi-Fi at the moment. It's just easier to get it out of the way. So we're going to do this one completely uploadable. I'm sure Rakshit, I'm in Rakshit's room now. So if there's anything weird behind me, like sex toys, they're Rakshit's. He didn't hear that, by the way. He's going to work it out in a little while when you all put it in the comments. But yeah, so this one, there won't be any super chats or anything on YouTube. It'll just be the people who ask the questions on Patreon, where you can find us at Good Areas Podcast. The first person that is signed up on Patreon is Reese, who says, was Test cricket better when there is a super team for everyone to chase or beat, or when there are 3, 4, 5 teams who could be considered the best in the world? I only ask because universally the 60s are accepted the most dour decade of cricket, and you would definitely not define that era as having a super team. I don't think that's ever a like a straightforward way of thinking about things. Like, I understand why you're asking the question, Reese. But I think you can have an era that is great when you have like one fantastic team and everyone's trying to beat them. But you could also have another era that's fantastic where you have a bunch of teams. And I think maybe late 90s Australia is the best way of looking at that, right? Late 90s, 90s was a really, really strong decade for Test cricket. There were, you know, lots of teams who were very good in different ways. And yet having Australia there, almost, I don't know if it gave it a centerpiece or whatever, but it made it very, very cool. So, so you could argue at that time that there is something to be said for that as well. Separate to that, though, I would say the last couple of years, and maybe what, around 2008 to 2013, were really, really fascinating as well, right? And part of the reason they were so fascinating is because we had so many teams who were really good, and we weren't even always sure who the number one team was at any one time. So I just think a good era is a good era. I think the 60s was coming into better cricket, and the 70s is probably just better cricket. And a lot of that is to do with the 50s and, you know, with changes around the world and teams getting stronger. But realistically, 80s and 90s are probably fascinating because we just had a lot of very good, varied teams is probably the way I would look at that. Hayden says, last year's Women's 50 over World Cup in India overlapped with the India versus West Indies men's test matches. This year, Women's T20 World Cup in England overlaps with New Zealand men's test tour and a white ball tour of the Indian men. Is this limiting the growth of these tournaments, or is it a sign of its growth? I've heard this a lot. In fact, the other argument I've heard is that they're playing a football World Cup at the same time, and that's what's going to cause a problem. There are sometimes, I think, when leagues and franchises and, you know, World Cups have been done just completely wrong. But what the administrators will always say is, find us a part in the schedule that works, right? When it comes down to it, if women's cricket is going to work, it has to work on its own, and it has to be, you know, it has to develop its own fan base. There is no time when there's no men's cricket. Right? Like, when it comes down to it, that's just always going to happen. So, I actually think if anything, I would almost not be worrying about that anymore. Like, we know how many people like women's cricket now. If the cricket is good, people will come. If the cricket's not good, well, then you have a bad World Cup no matter what happens. James says, why has cricketing culture had such low expectations of players' situational awareness, e.g. banning fake fielding instead of expecting batters to track the ball, taboo on man-cad runouts, and convoluted clauses in laws to restrict them, outcry over Bairstow. I'm trying to think if these are all the same. The fake fielding one, I don't know as much about, I'll be honest. I was around when it happened, but I don't remember I'd have to talk to someone like Fraser Stewart or Paul McMahon, and, you know, someone who knows these sorts of things on the laws committee. But I don't remember why exactly we ended up in that situation. I think Mancad came at a really weird time, which was after World War II, there was this whole thing of going back to the good old days of society via cricket. Like, it was a big part of it. And I do think at that stage, there was an element of that's not fair play. I'm kind of with you on that one. But yeah, I don't know about the convoluted clauses. And the Bairstow one, I actually think now, I would have thought the vast majority of hardcore cricket fans were pretty much on the side of Bairstow should have been in his crease. So yeah. Afif says, club cricket across the world has embraced digitalization with online scoring and stats. But why are the online forum discussions for cricket equipment, gear and tactics so bad? It's the other way around for tennis. Nobody necessarily has tennis stats, but you can find a very healthy discussion on which shoes work best for you. I wish we also shared field tactics for club cricket online. Club cricketers are immensely predictable everywhere. Yeah, I don't know why those other sports. I've always felt that there is something about tennis and golf where the equipment becomes a bigger deal. I don't know if it. I'm trying to think why. Maybe because in tennis you spend more, like, if you're a tennis player, you probably spend more time around tennis shops than you do as a cricket player. And part of the reason for that is restringing. So you're going back all the time. And maybe, you know, I remember when I played tennis, I would probably have my racket restrung every 3 to 4 weeks, right? You know, and I had multiple rackets because of how often I was breaking a string. I don't know if that's part of it. And so there's that side of it. Golfers seem really obsessed with stuff in a way that I haven't seen with cricket also. So I do think they're different sports. But I get your point. I think that there's actually a lot of missed obvious parts of cricket. And I think the great cricketer kind of showed this when they came through, right? Of like, some people just want to, you know, talk about cricket from a more club and player thing. And we've seen Wii cricket. We're now seeing, is it backyard cricket? So we're actually seeing parts of that sort of non-professional side come through. But yeah, I think tennis and golf are ahead of us, but obviously we're ahead of tennis and golf in many other ways. So, you know, I think tennis and golf would love to have a cricket phone, cricket buzz type situation, right? And they don't really. Hurt says, is form the most overused and absurd term in cricket? Everything said about a player's form seems pretty arbitrary until suddenly a player goes out and plays a spectacular innings. Unless there's something specific and observable to point to, like a batter's bat coming down at the wrong angle or a change in their trigger movements, isn't throwing the word form around pretty meaningless? So form is basically the ability to get into flow state, right? Form is the ability to do something without any physical limitations. Form is confidence. It's all these different things. It's very hard, hurts to go through and be like, oh, so that bat is like a millimeter out, or his trigger movement is 3 inches further than it should be at the moment. We might get to that, but at the moment, form is a shortcut for all of those things. That's why it's used. If someone's not seeing the ball very well at that time, how can you, as a pundit, fan, analyst, say, oh, I can see that their eyes are not focusing on the ball correctly at the moment, right? I think it was when Abhishek Sharma struggled in the World Cup. I remember we looked at that and we couldn't, like, it was a really hard thing to try and get to the bottom of. I thought there were some physical limitations after he got ill, and he looked a little bit stiffer to me, but also that led to bad form. So you're right, but if we don't have the technology or the ability to look at the other things. So I think at a certain point, you just have to accept that that's how it works. Shilpak says, should India debut Vaibhav Suryavanshi in T20 internationals within the next 6 to 9 months or wait for another 12 to 18 months? I think it's pretty expected he's going to play in Ireland, isn't it? So that's soon. He could potentially replace Sky. I think of the World Cup winning centre. I'm not sure what that means, sorry. The challenge is it does not make sense to rock the boat with Abhishek and Samson going so well at the top. So where do you fit him in? Or other strategy is you only give him a chance against weaker team like Zimbabwe in July and then rest one of the regular openers. Yeah, I think India's been pretty good over the last couple of years at resting and changing things around. So, you know, and getting other players in. So he'll definitely have a chance to play and probably have a chance to open is my guess. But yeah, going ahead, it's a fascinating one of how you fit him into the side. Who've they got? They've got Samson and they've got Abhishek. I don't think there's any reason why he can't really bat at number three, which is probably what you were talking about before. But I don't see any reason why he couldn't bat at number three. So I think there's always a chance of that. But there's no rush, right? Like they're a good team. They're a World Cup winning team. They can chill a little bit longer if they want to. Mob says, best of luck for the IPL final watch along party. What would you like to tell Wagon Wheelers about that? No, it's been fantastic so far. So we're in Dubai. That's why I'm in Rakshit's room at the moment. And Chandan's room, I think. Chandan was actually asleep when we started and Rakshit didn't tell me. And I just started the podcast and that woke Chandan up, which is really funny to me. Also, if I'd known Chandan was going to have a sleep, we could have done this in my room. So now it's even funnier. Anyway, look, I think for us, for Combox as a company, there's a lot of things we believe that should be done in cricket that haven't been done yet. And I think these big watch-along events is a definite part of that. But also the ability to get, you know, I mean, look at the players that we've got. We've got Srisanth, we've got Angelo Matthews, we've got Chris Gayle. The ability to bring all those people together to be able to tell stories is what we want to do on Combox. So live and, you know, online and offline, right? And if you know anyone in Dubai, it's going to be a hell of a fun event, right? And on top of that, if we can get pulled this off in Dubai, it makes it more likely that we go to other countries. So it's, you know, I think someone sent me a message the other day going, oh, you should do this in England. It's like, we want to do this everywhere, right? We want to go to, you know, every different country in the world and pull off these kind of events. So if you know anyone in Dubai who likes cricket, tell them to come. I can't wait to, you know, get on stage with these guys and chat nonsense with them. Ajit says, Jofra Archer has always had elite pace and skill, but do you think this IPL season is the first time since 2020 that he's actually looked physically sustainable across a full tournament? Or are we still underestimating how difficult it is for fast bowlers to repeatedly come back from long-term injuries? Yeah, I think it's just a very, very simple situation where you can come back from the long-term injuries, but where do you come back, right? So to go back to what Hertz was saying before, you know, it's similar with bowlers. You know, we don't say form, we say conditioning with bowlers, right? But Jasper Bumrah is a very good example of someone who's come back, probably not quite at 100%. Josh Hazlewood's come back, not quite at 100%. And so sometimes you come back, you're not 100%, and then you bowl for a while. And then if you're unlucky, you get injured again and you nick off. But sometimes you never quite get back to, I don't know what you need to be at a fast bowler, but probably what, 92 to 95% to feel yourself. You never quite feel 100% as a fast bowler, but maybe Jofra's been hanging around 85 to 92% or even lower at times. Then he gets injured again and gets a setback. So I do think there is, that is just a part of how it all works, right? And I don't think there's much you can do about that. He either doesn't play or he plays at 80%. And I think he's played a lot at 80%. And you're probably right, he's a little bit up. I still don't think he's peak Jofra. I don't think we've seen peak Jofra at the death yet. But new ball Jofra has certainly come back. And I think I might have said that last year, IPL, around that I thought he was almost back to his best with the new ball. But he wasn't outside of that. And I think when he gets hit now, he still doesn't have that seventh gear that he used to have before, which he could just stop anyone hitting him. Sam says, are we getting close to the saturation point with T20 cricket? I don't mean franchise league fatigue as much as I mean overall boredom with the format itself. There's something to be said about the scarcity to build excitement and interest. And the fact that cricket has three formats means there was much less fatigue going between the three. I think there's always been a bit of fatigue. The problem with T20 cricket has always been the very basic level that when the game finishes, people don't always remember it, right? When you put together league after league after league, I do think there's an element of that. I think if you look at the IPL leading into the PSL, sorry, the World Cup leading into the PSL and the IPL, it means you've got, what, three of the four biggest competitions probably around as far as, you know, eyeballs and attention, all back to back. And so it probably feels even more oppressive. And I know most people don't follow more than one league, but for the cricket fans who do, suddenly everything's going on at all times. So I do think there's a part of that. I think the big problem that T20 cricket will have, which it hasn't proven in a way that, let's say, baseball and football and basketball have, is can you play multiple games a day? Can you play really long seasons and keep that up? Every time we've seen a league have, you know, go for longer than about 3 weeks, people start to complain about the length of it. And it's because as cricket fans, we are not attuned to that. Then you have the consistency of that. So one league leads into another league, leads into another league. We actually don't know what the long-term impact of T20 cricket is. It's one of the reasons why I've been very clear with Test cricket specifically that we need to be very, very careful that we don't just let Test cricket go. ODI cricket should be saved by the 50-over World Cup for a while, but you don't want to be in a situation where you just lose Test cricket because you think T20 is the all-important and T20 cricket loses steam, right? You know, in the 1990s, one day cricket was bigger than Test cricket. And if you had said now that it would be the third biggest format in cricket, I think people would have laughed at you at that time. So this is why I've been so harsh on cricket administrators over the years. I don't think they think that way. They think whatever's happening now is going to be happening for a while. And actually, you need to understand that trends and the way that things go. We're breeding this whole new numbers of fans because of T20 cricket, because we're getting much higher numbers than we got from ODIs or T20 or tests, right? But if you look at the traditional, what happens is lots of people in the last 70 years have started as fans of shorter form cricket, and eventually they gravitate to the other one because there's more depth to it, there's more interesting, it's harder to predict, all these different things. If we don't have that, we have an issue. And I think that might be the problem with T20, is that if it doesn't get to the point where everyone is absolutely obsessed with it, and we're certainly not seeing that from a good areas perspective at the moment, then I think there is an issue going ahead. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Reese says, if control percentage had been invented from the very first test match and had been tracked for every test played, who out of your top 50 batters would have the lowest and who would have the highest? I think the highest would be, he's saying Cook, by the way, Reese. The highest would be Len Hutton, is my guess. Yeah, I'm going to go Len Hutton over Bradman and Hobbs and Sachin. Yeah, I think Len Hutton would have the highest control percentage of all time. Who would have the lowest control percentage? It's probably Sehwag or Trumper. I'm trying to think what Hayden's would have been. Now, Hayden wouldn't have been in that level. Yeah, I would have said Sehwag or Trumper. I don't know where Sobers would have come out there as well. But yeah, so those are players who probably took more risks and played and missed more and, you know, got everything else. Whereas Len Hutton is probably the best technically correct player. Everyone I talked to who batted with him or bowled to him or followed him or you read books on him or whatever, basically said he didn't make mistakes. And I think that even adjusting for errors and everything else, I can't find another player that anyone really said that about. Neil says, I'm a tall right-hand batter and I keep getting bowled to very full balls and I struggle to play them on the leg side. What could be going wrong beyond not watching the ball? Neil, not watching the ball is a very good place to start. I would check your backlift. If you're getting bowled from very full balls, and we've seen this with Vaibhav Suryavanshi recently, if you have a very high backlift, the bat has to go from all the way up here down low. And that was a big problem that I had. And my batting coach basically changed that over for me and said, you hit the ball really hard anyway. You don't need a massive big backlift. Halve your backlift and you'll be able to hit the full balls. And I've never had an issue with full balls since I changed my backlift. The other thing I would say is if you're struggling to play on the leg side, chances are you're playing around your pad. So I do a drill with kids. I've got three sweets in front of me here, which won't help at all. But I basically put one ball just outside off stump, and I put one ball on middle stump, and I put the other ball just outside leg stump. And I say, practice those three front movements. So stepping across, stepping straight, and stepping outside the line. If you step outside the line, you open up and your head will be over the top of the ball and your pad won't be in the way. And then you should be trying to play it between mid-on and mid-wicket, right? Or even straighter, like between mid-on and the bowler as well. Most people struggle to hit the ball on the leg side because they're trying to hit the ball on the leg side. You don't have, you know, if you, some players can do that naturally, you don't have to do that naturally. Essentially, what you really want to do is hit it straighter through the ball. And then you'll find you'll start to play more leg glances because occasionally the ball won't hit the middle of the bat anyway. So it will still go down there. So for most players, you really should be trying to hit straight and then allowing for the fact to be able to do that. And then if you, you eventually you might get to a point where you can understand how you can close your wrist if you want to play into gaps in the leg side. But you don't need to do that, Neil, right? It's very hard. If you can hit the ball firmly from, you know, middle stump and leg stump between mid-on and mid-wicket, it's actually very hard to set a field to you. PJ says, why did Gary Gilmore not play more? Was he an injury candidate? What is his legacy like in today's cricket? I think the problem with Gary Gilmore as much as anything is that people weren't really picking specialist players at that point. So Gary Gilmore obviously has one of the greatest ODI records of all time. He averages 42 at the bat with a strike rate of 107, and he has a bowling average of 10, but he only plays five games. And I think the period that he played, there weren't many one-dayers to play. And I think going back, he obviously should have played a lot more one-dayers, but he wasn't always in the test side. And part of that is because of how good the test side was. But also, as you've said, he was injured a lot. I think it was a foot or an ankle injury that he had, but they also had like incredibly other talented players, than anyone else. I think there was also a feeling he wasn't quite as devoted to the game as perhaps he should have been. But if you look at his domestic record, he played 75 games with an average of 31 with the ball, right? And 30 with the bat. So I think if Australia had been more the kind of team that liked to have a number seven who, and then maybe move Rod Marsh up to number six, and have a little bit of a weakness there and have the fifth bowler, they would have done that. But you've got to remember they had really strong bowling attacks. So Gilmore would have been behind Thompson, Lilly, Pascoe, Hogg at times. Lawson would have been, you know, probably a slightly better bowler than him as well. So there were lots of bowling options available. So they probably would have seen him as a bit more of a fifth bowler. But if limited overs cricket had been bigger, he swung the ball huge amount and he could bat and you know, average 30 in first class cricket, he probably just becomes an ODI star. But yeah, I think there was a few different issues there. Very talented player though. As far as legacy goes, he's kind of known as a, you know, as someone who wasn't involved all that much, but who has great numbers and everything else. Also I should say, I'm assuming also, yeah, he played World Series cricket, so he probably missed out on international. So if you looked up his World Series cricket numbers, you probably get a little bit more information on him. Ali says, if you bowl the seam orientated at an angle parallel to the ground, horizontal instead of vertical, does it get stuck, skid off the surface based on the seam position, the opposite orientation of a wobble ball? Yeah, what you're talking about, Ali, is the cross-seam delivery. Have we got a ball here, Akshay? Cricket ball? No, we don't have a ball here. If we had a ball here, so what the cross seam, I'll use this headphone case. So what the cross seam basically does is when the ball hits the seam, it stands up. And so it stops in the surface and it goes up. And when it hits the smooth side, it skids through. So, you know, Liam Plunkett has probably changed the way that we think about that ball quite a lot now. I talked about it in our slower ball series, delivery series, wasn't it? Where I basically put it in with the slower balls because that's kind of how they talk about it as cricketers, even though it's not quite a slower ball. But if you know, the real skill there is if you have the ability to know when you can get it to land on the seam and when you can get it to land on the smooth, but most people don't. But it means that you're almost making the pitch a little bit more stop-start than it needs to be. So it's a really good trick to do. You just don't want to do it with a newish ball. You want to do it with the older ball because you don't want to ruin the new ball. Afif says, change my view. Vaibhav Suryavanshi is ready to play and revolutionize test cricket into a 3 or 4 day format for good. He's certainly ready to play test cricket. Like, I think it'd be fascinating to see him play it at the moment. I don't think he really changes it into a 3 or 4 day format. If he is suddenly just the first of these players to come through and everyone bats at his speed, then perhaps, you might do that. But realistically, you're still going to have guys like Chris Rogers and Craig Brathwaite around, right? As far as I'm aware, in the history of cricket, there's only been one Vaibhav Suryavanshi. So in order for you to revolutionize the game, it would need to be 30 of them. And finding one was pretty tough for us. Mob says, now that the IPL round robins have finished, what is the single biggest surprise in terms of changing value between what was predicted to be good bad at the start and when it was actually eventuated? Apart from all of Mumbai. Yeah, Mumbai is definitely the one. I think on paper, that team still looks good, right? But form, maybe age curves, injuries, all played a part. Plus, I think they played everyone in Mumbai in their 11 at one stage. And I mean the entire city, not just the franchise. So, though they were one, I think Delhi still on paper looks like a much better team than it is. There are some issues, and obviously we don't always like the way they picked it. I think me and Rob talked about Delhi and we said they might be a good squad team, but not a good 11 team. And maybe that was something some of us missed. I had Rajasthan to come last, and Rajasthan are at the very worst going to be third. Having said that, I didn't expect Suryavanshi to keep going at the same level. Like, I didn't think he would drop off, but I thought, you know, he'd have a couple of good innings and, you know, I didn't think he'd be that leading run scorer. And I wasn't predicting that Jofra would be as good as he was. But they've had a fantastic season considering it's been basically just a couple of players. And I think if you look at their squad on paper compared to other squads, you'd be like, should they really be third? But when I think this is one thing that you learn about, you know, we saw with Lucknow last year when Lucknow won a bunch of games because Nicholas Perrin made runs, where T20 cricket is still sort of very similar to basketball in that one, two, three players can make an incredible difference, right? Whereas we don't see that as much in the other formats. And so if you can get your three best players in form, it might be better than having a good all-round team. And that's awful and not the way the cricket fans probably want things to go, but I think that's definitely something we still see. Ajit says, have you witnessed anything similar to Punjab's bottle job in other cricket leagues tournaments across any format? Not just a favourite that never turned up, but more so a team flying high and then crashing and burning so far. I've seen it in every format of cricket ever. Yeah, it's a very common thing. I think for some reason people think this is the first time this has ever happened. They won six games in a row and they lost six games in a row. That's fairly normal across sports, especially when you have a more of an even league like this. I think this is a very, very normal thing to have happened. Sam says, would it be overstating it to say watching following the women's game is more interesting and engaging than the men's? I will often choose to watch a women's match over men's if I've got the choice. The differing dynamics of lower scoring, the fact that not every other ball is going over the boundary, the more likely you are to come across a player that you've never seen before. I only watch a women's 100. I don't particularly bother with the men's. Granted, I don't particularly care for that format. I would say that I find the WPL more interesting than the IPL. I suppose some of that, Sam, is the way you look at it. So in the 90s, I started watching a lot more women's basketball than men's basketball. And the reason was that it was much more interesting tactically because at that stage, a lot of men's basketball was either dumping the ball just down low and waiting for a post move or having some very athletic 6'6" guy dribble around for a couple of seconds and then just take a fadeaway anyway. And I found that really boring basketball. And in women's basketball, you didn't have as much of that sort of, you know, over and over post play. And if you did have post play, it was post play from a dynamic point of view where there was passing. You know, the screens were much better. The spacing was much better. Like it just flowed more as basketball. So that doesn't mean that it was better basketball or that it was more interesting. It meant it was more interesting to me. Whereas other people might, you know, they're going to be, that was their favorite era of basketball. And maybe women's era is better now and everything else. So I think it depends on what sort of attracts you to the game and how these things work. PJ says, while I'm not the target market for it, as I personally haven't watched a single ball of the IPL, nor do I really care about the results, I'm curious about how the transition has been to daily watch-alongs for both the World Cup and the IPL. Has the traction been worth the effort? Is it losing money or making money? And how does it feel to essentially be working every day? I know it's your job, but is the passion still there compared to, say, like a writing project that you want to do? I work every day anyway, so that hasn't changed for me. I think knowing that you've got a four-hour block on most days and having to schedule your working day around it is different, and you certainly have to play a part there. We weren't doing the watch-alongs as a money-making effort. We were doing the watch alongs because what was the original plan was is because of the, we were going to do live watch alongs in cities during the IPL in India. And then when the war happened, we couldn't get anything done for the first month. We had a deal for the second month that fell through at the last minute. So we were doing the watch alongs as much as anything else so that when we went to these cities and did these watch alongs, there was already a built-in audience. So we could say to sponsors, look, we already have the hardcore audience. We'll get the casuals as we move forward with, you know, promoting it and marketing it and bringing, you know, like imagine we you know, it might have been, you know, me, Robbie, Ashwin, you know, whoever else, you know, Irfan Pathan or Dale Steyn, whoever else we brought in, right? Those sort of watch-alongs obviously is a very different level to what we're doing at the moment. No disrespect to Shavan and Akshay, but, you know, it's obviously a very different kind of thing. But we wanted to make sure that we had the habit on the channel so that we could start there. So it hasn't quite worked the way we wanted because those things fell out. But having those watch-alongs has also helped get the Stars Play deal and hopefully into the future. A watch-along is no different than commentary for me. And quite often if I'm doing test matches, like if I do a test match series, so I will be doing, I think, all three tests of New Zealand, England. I think that's right. For TalkSport, I'm going to be commentating for 8 hours a day, right? Like as far as that's how long I need to be in the ground. And I will be writing and everything else. So the IPL is actually less work than that. So yeah, it's very normal for me. Ali says, does Baba middle the ball the most? If not, then who? I would have to look at the control stats to be sure on that. I think Virat's a very high level of middling the ball. But yeah, probably be a player like that, I would have thought. Probably would have been BJ Watling when he played. Craig Brathwaite would be another interesting one to look at. Pujara, Chris Rogers, those type of players. But yeah, I don't know if we have a, like an actual stat on that. Maybe obviously in the future we will. But you'd probably be looking more at control percentage. It's still a little bit subjective, but it will give you a good idea of how often someone does something like that. Anyway, that is it for me this week on Wagon Wheel. Chandan can go back to sleep. Rakshit can stop pacing the room. And we will see you again very shortly for more on Combox. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Rakshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.